All right, why don't we get started? Good morning to everybody. Did anyone have something they wanted the class to be praying about before we get rolling? Not, I can pray. Is it the luncheon today? Why am I smelling food? Yeah. Smells good. All right, let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for the reminder that despite the chaos we see around us, you remain sovereign and in control, and we trust that you are moving history toward the resolution of all this sin, conflict, pain we see around us, and that you work all things together for the good of those who love you. Even when to us that feels impossible to see, we ask that you would help us to trust you in the midst of the chaos, that you do love us, that someday you will end pain and suffering, that someday you will transform our hearts so that we can be people who perfectly reflect your goodness, your love, your kindness. We ask, in the meantime, that you would give strength to those of us in our body who are suffering and carrying heavy burdens, that you would assist them, that you would help us to assist each other with the things that we are able to do. We thank you for the message of Job and ask for your help as we continue to wrestle with it. In Jesus' name, amen. All right. So we have made it to Job's closing argument, the final speech by Job, and it's an interesting mix. I think it's helpful in terms of seeing where, after all the talk, Job finally lands in his feelings. And last week we saw he begins by reaffirming his agreement with the sovereignty of God. Nevertheless, at the beginning of chapter 27, he says, "I still maintain that I have not committed any sort of terrible sin that would be congruent with my terrible suffering, and I'm not going to agree with you guys," meaning his three friends, "as long as I live, that I've done something terrible that needs to be confessed, and that explains my suffering." And he does re-criticize God and essentially say, "God has denied me justice." But then in the rest of the chapter, he goes on to say, "But I'm still throwing in my lot with God, because I know that the end of the wicked is hopeless. And so even though I feel like God is being unfair to me right now, and I may not like God, I know God's sovereign, and I know to abandon God is hopeless. So I'm sticking with God." And that's what we've covered so far. So we're going to pick up at 28:1. This is still Job talking, and it feels kind of like a Shaggy Dog story, or like Monty Python used to say, "And now for something completely different," because he seems to be shifting gears, and he gives us a nice little essay on ancient mining. So 28:1, he says, "There is a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined. Iron is taken from the earth, and copper is smelted from ore." So that little stanza is kind of a reminder that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Iron, copper, silver, gold, all substances we're still interested in. And it turns out that however long Job was written, 3,000, or how long the events take place, 3,000, 3,500 years ago, people were already mining and digging in the earth. Obviously, they didn't have the same tools we have, but they were interested in those substances, and they put great effort to look for them. And so we have almost no written records about mines from Job's time, But we do know there are minds, and no one knows how old they are. And so some of the oldest written descriptions we have of minds comes from this area in Greece, south of Athens. And we know that in the time of, for example, the Athenian Empire and the war with Sparta, that they would send criminals to work these mines, and it was regarded as a virtual death sentence because the work was so dangerous and so difficult. And the historians in that time period, which is around like 400 BC, said some of these mines are so old, we don't even know when they were created. And there are other mines we've found in places like Africa that are so old, there's no written record of when they were made. So people are digging in the earth, and Job's going to tell us about it. He says, man puts an end to the darkness. I think what he's picturing is people carrying lanterns through these mines where it's pitch black. He searches the furthest recesses for ore and the blackest darkness. Far from where people dwell, he cuts a shaft in places forgotten by the foot of man. Far from men, he dangles and sways. So picture people lowering themselves on ropes, trying to get to these places where these precious substances that they want are. The earth from which food comes is transformed below as by fire. The NIV has sapphires. We actually, the commentators say, we don't really know what jewel the Hebrews talking about. They think of better argument might be lapis lazuli. Anyway, sure, go with that. Lapis lazuli, my wife, who has better pronunciation than me, says. So anyway, jewels come from its rocks. Its dust contains nuggets of gold. No bird of prey knows that hidden path. No falcon's eye has seen it. Proud beasts do not set foot on it. No lions prowl there. Man's hand assaults the flinty rock and lays bare the roots of the mountains. He tunnels through the rock. His eyes see all its treasure. He searches the sources of the rivers and bring hidden things to light. So he's picturing the enormous effort people in his time went to search for and find these substances. And then we find out what he's really interested in. But where can wisdom be found? Where does understanding dwell? The NIV in 13 has man does not comprehend its worth, but I think the commentators make a good argument that a better translation would be man does not comprehend its source or its place. So in other words, we know how to go find gold. It's really hard, but we make the effort, but we don't know where to go to the wisdom mine. There isn't a mine where you can go and pull nuggets of wisdom out of the ground and store up wisdom, I think is the comparison he's making. And that's based on the verses that come right after it. He says, it cannot be found in the land of the living. So nowhere you can walk around on the surface of the earth. The deep says, it is not in me. So you can't find it in the bottom of the sea. The sea says, it is not with me. There's also not a market you can go to where you can buy it. You can't order it from Amazon. It cannot be bought with the finest gold, nor can its price be weighed in silver. It cannot be bought with the gold of Ophir, which is someplace it was known for high quality gold, evidently, with precious onyx or sapphires. Again, that's that word that Laura knows how to pronounce. Neither gold nor crystal can compare with it, nor can it be had for jewels of gold. Coral and jasper are not worthy of mention. The price of rubies, the price of wisdom is beyond rubies. The topaz of Cush cannot compare with it. It cannot be bought with pure gold. So evidently, MasterCard owes whoever wrote Job some royalties, because this is sort of the original, this is all this value, but this is priceless kind of thing. Gold is nice, the author of Job says, but wisdom is beyond that. So if it's so wonderful, and you can't go get it from a market, how do we get it? Where then does wisdom come from? Where does understanding dwell? It is hidden from the eyes of every living thing, concealed even from the birds of the air. Destruction and death, so even if you could get to the netherworld, they say only a rumor of it has reached our ears. God understands the way to it. He alone knows where it dwells, for he views the ends of the earth and sees everything under heaven. When he established the force of the wind and measured out the waters, when he made a decree for the rain and a path for the thunderstorm, then he looked at wisdom and appraised it. He confirmed it and tested it. And he said to man, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding. So Job affirms that even though he's unhappy with God and he feels like God is not treating him justly, that God is the source of wisdom. He's the only source of wisdom. He loops back to creation as evidence that God has the ability to know everything, and that's why he's the source of wisdom. And that for humans, fearing the Lord and paying attention is how we get wisdom. And he is not throwing in his lot with evil. He recognized that is folly, even though he's not happy with God right now. All right? Questions, comments, concerns? All right. So I think this is important in understanding the limits of Job's criticism of God, right? He's still a person of faith. He's just unhappy and feels like he's being treated unfairly. All right, so now he's going to switch gears, and he's going to talk about life before all his suffering began. How I long for the months gone by, for the days when God watched over me. And some nuance needs to be added to that. Job still thinks God sees everything. So that what he's talking about is watching over him in a protective sense, kind of a Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd sense. So he's contrasted in this book being watched over like by a hall monitor. Here he's talking about being watched over by someone who is trying to protect you. When his lamp shone upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness. So there was a time in Job's life where he felt like God was guiding him and helping him see the path he needed to go. Oh, for the days when I was in my prime, when God's intimate friendship blessed my house, when the Almighty was still with me and my children were around me, when my path was drenched with cream and the rock poured out for me streams of olive oil. So he lists in very poetic, stylistic language some of the blessings he experienced before his suffering, including a sense of fellowship with God. I think it's interesting that he lists that first, including the gift of family and having children. And then finally, after that, he gets to material prosperity. And then he gives us concrete examples of how he was blessed. When I went to the gate of the city, which is where people used to do meetings and things, and took my seat in the public square, the young men saw me and stepped aside. And the old men rose to their feet. So in that society, it's natural for the young men to stand up for someone older than them. It is unusual for an older person to show respect to someone younger than them. So Job is saying, I had an unusual level of respect in the days of yore. The chief men refrained from speaking. So even people with higher social status and covered their mouths with their hands. The voices of the nobles were hushed, and their tongues stuck to the roof of their mouths. Whoever heard me spoke well of me, and those who saw me commended me. Because I rescued the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to assist him. So remember how Eliphaz accused Job of certain rich guy's sins. Job is going to argue in this chapter and the next chapter, I didn't do any of that. And here's one of the examples. I actually helped people who were in need, so I used my wealth for good. The man who is dying blessed me, and I made the widow's heart sing. What we think's going on there is he's, you know, in that age, men are the breadwinners, the protectors for the household. Widows are really vulnerable. So he's portraying someone who knows that the man of the household's dying. How are they going to provide for themselves going forward? Job is saying, I stepped in and made sure they were taken care of financially and otherwise. So that's what that stanza means. I put on righteousness as my clothing. Justice was my robe and my turban. I was eyes to the blind, feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy. I took up the case of the stranger. I broke the fangs of the wicked and snatched the victims from their teeth. So I was using my power for good. I thought, I will die in my own house. My days is numerous as the grains of sand. So I will live to a ripe old age, as we say. My roots will reach to the water. My dew will lie all night on my branches. My glory will remain fresh in me, the bow ever new in my hand. So I thought things would go on in this blessed state until I died on my bed, peacefully surrounded by my great-great-grandchildren. Men listened to me expectantly, waiting in silence for my counsel. After I had spoken, they spoke no more. My words fell gently on their ears. They waited for me as for showers and drank in my words as the spring rain. When I smiled at them, they scarcely believed it. The light of my face was precious to them. I chose the way for them and sat as their chief. I dwelt as a king among his troops. I was like one who comforts mourners. So everything was peaches and cream. But now they mock me, men younger than I, so people who should respect Job, whose fathers I would have disdained to put with my sheepdogs. So dogs are a big deal in our culture. They weren't in their culture. They were considered unclean because they ate things that were nasty. And so you didn't want to be around dogs in Job's culture. And so people who had to work with dogs are the lowest of the low. And so Job is drawing a picture of how disrespected he is. This is his Rodney Dangerfield moment, for those of you who are old as me. Of what use was the strength of their hands to me, since their vigor had gone from them? So these people, not only are the people who work with the dogs, they're people who aren't even good workers anymore. Haggard from want and hunger, they roam the parched land and desolate wastelands at night. So these are people who are now cut off from respectable society. They're just wandering around in the bush. In the brush, they gathered salt herbs, and their food was the root of the broom tree. They were banished from their fellow men, shouted at as if they were thieves. They were forced to live in the dry stream beds, among the rocks and in holes in the ground. They brayed among the bushes and huddled in the undergrowth. A base and nameless brood, they were driven out of the land. So he's very graphic description of the lowest of the low socially in his time. And he says, and now their sons mock me in song. So now the lowest of the low makes fun of me. For those of you who are from Alabama, do we have anyone else who's from Alabama here? All right. So my parents are from Mississippi. I grew up in Alabama. This is like Alabama making fun of Mississippi. Like the rest of the nation thinks Alabama is a joke, right? Alabama, we say, thank goodness for Mississippi, right? I actually think people from Mississippi do the same thing to Alabama, okay? So he's kind of saying, even the people from Alabama make fun of me, okay? They detest me and keep their distance. They do not hesitate to spit in my face. Now that God has unstrung my bow and afflicted me, they throw off restraint in my presence. And so he kind of portrays people being able to attack him because his strength is utterly broken. He's unable to defend himself. On my right, the tribe attacks. They lay snares for my feet. They build their siege ramps against me. They break up my road. They succeed in destroying me without anyone's helping them. They advance as through a gaping breach. Amid the ruins, they come rolling in. Terrors overwhelm me. My dignity is driven away as by the wind. My safety vanishes like a cloud. And now my life ebbs away. Days of suffering grip me. Night pierces my bones, or at night, God pierces my bones. My gnawing pains never rest. This next verse is really difficult to translate. If you have the ESV, you'll get a flavor of that by how they translated it. The NIV went with, in his great power, God becomes like clothing to me, which is not a good translation. The NIV has in the margin, God grasps my clothing. And the commentators make a good argument that what's going on in this verse is Job is picturing God grabbing him right here and flinging him into the mud. It's like a wrestler grabbing someone around the head and shoulders and just tossing him down. Every now and then you kind of see that happen in a football game where one of the linemen's able to do that to another one. So he binds me like the neck of my garment. That's talking about grabbing him, and then 19 kind of clears it up. He throws me into the mud, and I am reduced to dust and ashes. And here's where I think Job is off base. I do think God is sovereign. We know that God chooses to allow Satan to do this. But if you hear that passage, what I think it also implies is a motive, that these things are happening because God is angry at him. And he's talked about that earlier in the book, that he feels like God is treating him like an enemy and he's angry with him. And that's where I think he's wrong. I don't think these things are happening because God is angry at him, because of the way God is portrayed in chapters 1 and 2 and what we're going to see at the end of the book. But as you can imagine, that's how it feels to Job. Feels like this must be happening because God is angry to me. He says, I cry out to you, O God, but you do not answer. I stand up, but you merely look at me. And so Job says, I've been praying to you, and nothing seems to be happening, so it feels like you're just ignoring me. You turn on me ruthlessly. With the might of your hand, you attack me. You snatch me up and drive me before the wind. You toss me about in the storm. I know you will bring me down to death, to the place appointed for all the living. So Job feels like God has turned on him, and it's not going to stop until he physically dies. And here he kind of complains about that. Again, this is really hard to translate, but we think we've got the gist of it, which is surely no one lays a hand on a broken man when he cries for help in his distress. And we might say you don't kick someone when they're down. So Job is saying, I'm utterly broken, and yet it feels like you're continuing to pummel me. Have I not wept for those in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? Yet when I hoped for good, evil came. When I looked for light, then came darkness. The churning inside of me never stopped. So he's basically saying my guts are in constant turmoil. So I'm having physical manifestations of all the things that have happened to me. Days of suffering confront me. I go about blackened, but not by the sun. We're not sure what's going on there. So some people think he means he wears black all the time because he's still grieving. Other people think his skin disease is actually affecting the color of his skin. Not sure. I kind of go with the skin disease people because he's going to talk about his skin some more, but no one knows. I stand up in the assembly and cry for help. I love this line, but it's hard to understand. I've become a brother of jackals, a companion of owls. And what we think he actually means is, like, when he stands up in the assembly and cries for help, he sounds like a jackal or an owl, which was an unpleasant sound in that society. So I am so distraught and broken that I screech like an owl or like a jackal, and no one likes that. My skin grows black and peels. My body burns with fever. My harp is tuned to mourning, and my flute to the sound of wailing. So there's no happy music coming from me. It's all gloom and doom. So that is Job's feeling about his current estate. Questions, comments, concerns about that? All right, let's keep going. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Oh, yeah, I don't know the answer to that. The point is that everyone agrees it's a bird that makes a nasty noise. So pick your bird. All right, so then he's going to transition, and this is a big part of the next chapter of his argument that what's happening in his case is unjust. He's going to describe the efforts he made to be faithful to God. And first he says, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. And that is interesting, the way he talks about himself as though it has divided desires. So covenants in that era were made between one person of lower standing and a higher standing. And usually there were obligations that the vassal agrees to the lord or the king, and responsibilities that the king or the lord has to the other. And here he's saying, the decision-making part of me told my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. And I think the idea that we have conflicting desires is something that carries on even into the New Testament era. I would argue we see that even in Romans when Paul says, the evil I don't want to do, I do. And I think you kind of see it in the Gospels too, when Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount says, hey, if your hand is leading you astray, cut it off. So until we're glorified, the way I would piece all that together is that until we're glorified, because of our fallen nature, we are going to have evil tendencies. But even in the Old Testament era, they recognize that, and so they practice disciplines to try to regulate their behavior as close to God's desires as they could. We have an advantage over them because in the New Testament era, we have the indwelling of the Holy Spirit who helps us, and we call that process sanctification. But I think Galatians and Romans teach that even in this era, we aren't perfect yet, and so the flesh still wages war against the Spirit, and our goal is to yield to the Spirit as much as we can and display the fruits of the Spirit in our lives rather than the works of the flesh. So here Job is saying, look, I did this thing, and the interesting thing about it that I think, again, the more things change, the more they stay the same, I think in Job's culture, a rich guy like him, perfectly acceptable to do what he's saying he wouldn't do. It would have been perfectly acceptable in his culture, even though he's married and has these kids, as he grows older, to acquire additional women that he could treat as either a concubine or a second or third wife. But Job knew God's ideal was higher than that, and he's choosing to make his behavior in accordance with God's ideal, not just what's acceptable in his culture. So I think it's important for us, as we see cultural practices drifting from what we think is God's ideal, not to whine too much about that, because that's generally been the way human societies have been. And God has always expected his followers to be willing to stand out from the crowd, even when it's embarrassing, painful, and other people think you're stupid. And here we're seeing, however many thousands of years ago, Job was willing to do that. Why? He says, "For what is man's lot from God above, his heritage from the Almighty on high? Is it not ruin for the wicked, disaster for those who do wrong? Does he not see my ways and count my every step?" So Job believes God knows everything he does and can hold him accountable for it. And so that's why he's so committed to doing what God wants, even though he could get away with something different in his culture. And then he goes through this interesting series of things where he basically says, "I would be willing to accept curses from God if I'd done these things." And it's a rhetorical way of arguing, "I haven't done any of this stuff." So he says, "If I have walked in falsehood, or my foot has hurried after deceit." And again, notice the distinction between body parts and like the decision-making part. So my feet may desire to engage in deceit, but I don't want them to do that. "Let God weigh me in honest scales, and he will know that I am blameless. If my steps have turned from the path, if my heart has been led by my eyes, or if my hands have been defiled." So if I've allowed these fleshly tendencies to lead me astray, "then may others eat what I have sown, and may my crops be uprooted." So I would accept that curse if I'd done these things. But I haven't, he's arguing. "If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I've lurked at my neighbor's door, then may my wife grind another man's grain, so may she be a servant in someone else's household, and may other men sleep with her." Now, his wife may think that's not the most fair punishment, Job. But to Job, that is a punishment on him, because his job is to protect his wife and honor her, and so he's saying, "Take that away from me. For that would have been shameful, a sin to be judged. It," meaning adultery, "is a fire that burns to destruction. It would have uprooted my harvest. If I have denied justice to my men servants and maid servants," so if I treated my own servants unjustly, "when they had a grievance against me, what will I do when God confronts me? What will I answer when called to account? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one form us both within our mothers?" So this tells us people in the ancient world who are paying attention to the revelation received from God understood that there was an equality of humans. We would say we're all made in the image of God, and that trumped social status. And so even though these people are Job's servants, and again, culturally, he could probably get away with abusing them, he wouldn't do that because he knows that violates God's standards. I would argue that is a big indictment of the way slavery was practiced in America, where legally we said people were property. I don't think you can support that from Scripture, even though there were Christians at the time who tried to. All right. "If I've denied the desires of the poor, or let the eyes of the widow grow weary, if I've kept my bread to myself, not sharing it with the fatherless," and this sounds a lot like passages in James, so if I just said, "Be warmed and be filled," instead of giving them bread, "but from my youth I reared him as would a father, and from my birth I guided the widow, so I helped the orphans and the widows around me. If I have seen anyone perishing for lack of clothing," so if I saw someone who was literally going to die because they did not have clothes, "or a needy man without a garment, and his heart did not bless me for warming him with the fleece from my sheep. So I gave him what he needed so he could have clothes. If I have raised my hand against the fatherless, which was a common thing in his time period, to take advantage of those people because they were vulnerable, knowing that I had influence in court. So that's a particular way of taking advantage of them. One of the problems in administering justice throughout history is when a judge knows that there are advantages to be gained from pleasing somebody. And so especially if you have all the branches of government, so to speak, all the roles of government trying to hand out justice as well, they know their power depends on the support of the nobles, and so there's an incentive if a noble person has a complaint against someone who has no wealth, power, influence, to just do what the nobleman wants, regardless of what is just. And so Job is saying, if I had done that, which has been a really common thing throughout history, then let my arm fall off from the shoulder. So if I use my power, talking about his arm, unjustly, then break my arm. But he says, I didn't do that, for I dreaded destruction from God. So even if you could get away from it, he knew God holds people accountable, and for fear of his splendor, I could not do such things. Then he moves on to idolatry, but he puts it in a way that's still relevant today. He says, if I have put my trust in gold, or said to pure gold, you are my security. That's an interesting way of thinking about idolatry. Do we think of our security as coming from our financial planning and our retirement accounts, our income? Or do we view God as the real source of our material security? So he's saying, if I had trusted in the wealth I was building rather than in God, that would be idolatry. If I have rejoiced over my great wealth, and he's talked about how he did enjoy his wealth, but he's saying it is possible to rejoice over that too much and to view that as an idol instead of looking to God. The fortune my hands had gained, if I have regarded the sun in its radiance or the moon moving in splendor. So for some reason in the ancient world, that's a really common thing, is you worship the moon or the sun or other celestial objects and somehow imagine that by doing that, you can manipulate things so that you want them. And if you think about it, idolatry is really about control. I want to trust things I control rather than something I don't, because with our fallen nature, what we all really want is control. I mean, we're driven to that. So that my heart was secretly enticed, and my hand offered them a kiss of homage, then these also would be sins to be judged, for I would have been unfaithful to God on high. So he's firmly in the monotheist camp, and says, if I trusted anything but God, I would have been committing idolatry and deserve to be judged. He says, if I rejoiced at my enemy's misfortune or gloated over the trouble that came to him, and we've talked, I kind of foreshadowed this when he talked about a verse earlier and a couple chapters ago. There are parts of the Old Testament that sure sound to the modern ear like they're either doing that or coming really close to gloating over the enemy. I think the way to try and thread the needle to the extent you can is it's one thing to ask God to administer justice on the people. It's another to gloat over them and to curse them and to say, I want these people to die, to effectively commit the problem that the New Testament is talking about where it says, judge not, lest you be judged. So he's saying, I didn't commit that relational sin. And the other thing he's going to talk about are other forms of relational sin. He says, I have not allowed my mouth to sin by evoking a curse against his life. So I may have asked God to impose justice on him, but I haven't actually cursed him in the sense of wishing him to die. If the men of my household had never said, who has not had his fill of Job's meat? So that is a complicated way of saying, I always helped strangers who needed a meal. And what he's portraying his servants is saying, oh, that there was someone who not had his fill from Job's household. Why are they saying that? Because they're the ones that prepare the meal. And they feel like they are constantly having to prepare meals for travelers, strangers. So they're doing all this work, and they're wishing there was someone that he wasn't willing to give a meal to. And so it's sort of an elaborate way of saying, hey, I was really generous with people who needed meals from me. He says, but no stranger had to spend the night in the street, for my door was always open to the traveler. And that kind of kindness to travelers is an important ethical principle recognized in the ancient world. But as important as it was, it's also really easy to violate because travelers are vulnerable. And so again, Job is saying, I didn't do that. Because I so feared, if I've concealed my sin as men do by hiding my guilt in my heart. So this is another kind of relational sin. It's the sin of trying to appear better than you really are to the people around you for social gain. He says, if I had done that because I so feared the crowd and so dreaded the contempt of the clans that I kept silent and would not go outside. And then he breaks off and doesn't get to the curse and says, oh, that I had someone to hear me. I sign now my defense. Let the Almighty answer me. And the commentators say this is almost like he's saying, I'm signing my legal brief. This is my brief that I'm submitting to God. Look at how hard I tried to please God. How does that square with my current circumstances? And remember what his friends have been arguing to him, and I think he's sort of believed it, which is you must have done something wrong. Your circumstances mean you did something wrong and you have something to repent. And so he's now saying, if you think I've committed sins, and Eliphaz was actually willing to accuse him, then list them. So he says, let my accuser put his indictment in writing. And he's even imagining God doing that. And he says, surely I would wear it on my shoulder. I would put it on like a crown. So he says, if you list the things you think I've done wrong, I'd be willing to own it. And it's not because he thinks he's done them. It's because he thinks he can disprove it. So he's saying, just give me a list of charges and I will win. His frustration is that the suffering he's experienced looks bad to everyone else who has this worldview we've talked about, but it doesn't say what he's actually done wrong to end up there. So from Job's point of view, there's no way I can refute it. You all think I've done something bad, but because it's unnamed, I can't respond to it. He says, I would give him an account of my every step. Like a prince, I would approach him. And then he goes back to the cursing thing. And by the way, that feels out of order that he does it that way. And so one thing, if you pick up academic commentaries, this last section of Job, they will rearrange. It's like they're tossing tinker toys up in the air and then putting them back together a way that they think is better. And so they'll take parts of this and say, Job didn't really say that, even though it says Job said it was actually one of the other friends and it didn't happen in this order and that order. I don't think there's any good basis to do that. So I'm just kind of sticking with the order we got, and I think that's the best approach. So I would argue he breaks it off, and it's just emotion driving it. And then he goes back and kind of finishes up the cursing. If my land cries out against me and all its furrows are wet with tears, if I have devoured its yield without payment or broken the spirit of its tenants. So here he's talking about the sin of being unfair to your laborers, whether they're your servants or people for hire. And he's saying, then let briars come up instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. So if I've been unfair to the people that work my land, then let my land become unproductive. And then we're told the words of Job are ended. So that ends his argument. So he kind of, his closing argument is, look at how hard I've tried to please God. That's not congruent with my circumstances. And his conclusion is, that feels unjust. Questions, comments, concerns about where Job is at? Yeah. Yep.
I would argue that that's also something still
valuable. Yeah, so the comment is we still take advantage of vulnerable people today, and yeah, you're absolutely 100% right. And that's another thing that we can learn from and apply to ourselves today, and I think New Testament principles would tell us we are supposed to be looking out for the vulnerable among us, and one of the ways we can display the heart of God to people around us is to watch out for the vulnerable and show that kindness to them. So yes, I think that's something we still need to do. Our society is still leaving people behind. Anything else? We'll go there and then there. I think the action in it predates it. I think it was likely written after the Pentateuch. So I think Job and his friends know nothing of the Pentateuch, is my position.
What's interesting then is verse 33, that he refers to
Anna's
transgression.
So what she's bringing up in 31:33. Is that some translations have, if I have concealed my sin as Adam did, other people think it means as men do, so as humans do. So there's a split. If it means as Adam did, it means he's familiar with the story of Adam and Eve. And he may have been, even if he didn't have the Pentateuch. Because remember, we don't think Moses invented the story of Adam and Eve. We think he recorded the story of Adam and Eve. So I would argue that even if he knows that story, that doesn't mean he has Moses' version of the story. But that would be interesting if, you know, he's part of the oral tradition that's preserving that story from generation to generation and eventually to Moses. But we don't know. We can't tell for sure that that's a reference to Adam. So it really helps to compare translations with Job. You had a question.
Okay, so in my NIV, there is like hyphens everywhere.
Yep.
And so I didn't know if there's anything significant going on as a literary device or something, why there'd be hyphens like almost on every verse.
Yep.
Is it just because of, or is there anything
significant? So what's going on in this whole chapter that's a problem throughout the chapter is there are all these conditional clauses where he starts by saying, if this, and then the then clause is far removed from it.
So the hyphen's just keeping your if going?
Kind of, yes. It's trying to get that across, that the modern English translations are struggling how to be faithful to the Hebrew language and yet also make the connections they believe between the if clauses and the then clear to the modern reader. But it's not an easy translation task, this chapter, because of that structure. Yeah, I mean, languages work differently, so it's a big struggle. And you can sometimes argue. Good. Any other hands? All right. So you would think, oh, Job's words are ended. Now it's time for God to show up. But no, there's more. So look at 32, and we aren't going to get through all of Elihu's speech. So these three men stopped answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. And we think what that means there is they could tell that they weren't going to say anything that was going to change Job's opinion. And so remember, they think Job's done something wrong, and so to help him, they need to get him to confess that. They're giving up and crying uncle and saying, we can tell, we're not going to move you. But then we find out there's this other dude who's been watching this whole thing the whole time. But Elihu, son of Barachel the Buzzite of the family of Ram, became very angry with Job for justifying himself rather than God. So we find out there's this other guy named Elihu. We think he's from the region of Edom, which would be close to where some of the other friends are from, who's been listening to all this, and his take on it is that he's angry with Job. And what I think is interesting about that is that I would bet most modern readers read this, and the people they're angry with are Job's friends, not Job. How many people at this point are angry with Job? Who's willing to raise their hand to that? We got one who's angry with Job. Woohoo! You go, girl. Why are you angry with Job?
Because you think he's righteous and
blameless. All right. Yeah, you're Team Elihu. Well said. All right. So you're this next speech is for you. Okay. I think part of the reason we get Elihu is that I think the author of Job knows that's how the majority of his audience is thinking. Okay? And one of the things that I think people in the OT excelled at that were believers was they understood and practice in a way we've kind of gotten sloppy about the awesomeness of God and the superiority of God, and that it is impertinent, to understate it, for us to criticize God given the difference between us. And so they took concrete steps to avoid doing that. And one of the examples that you're taught in seminary is they didn't just throw around the covenant name for God. They tried not to say that out loud. And so for a long time, we even misunderstood what the covenant name for God was, because when they went back and added vowels to their texts of the Old Testament, they put in different vowels around the covenant name of the Lord to remind them not to say the wrong name out loud and to say some other name that people would know what they were talking about. And so supposedly that's where Jehovah comes from. So one of the things you learn in seminary, and some of you have probably heard this before, is Jehovah's not really a word. Jehovah is actually the combination of the covenant name of the Lord and different vowels. That's how highly they respected God and how they understood the difference between his holiness and us. And so Elihu is listening to Job, and he's having the how dare you reaction, the thing that our politicians love to say about utterly trivial stuff. How dare you? You can't criticize God. You can't say something negative about God. And I think Elihu is going to make some important contributions to the debate in that vein. I think another reason the audience might be having that reaction is that if you go back, I think the audience that's reading this probably is living in the Pentateuch era. And if you go back to Deuteronomy, there's this whole chapter where, starting in 28, where Moses lays out the material blessings Israelites can experience if they obey the Lord. And there are all kinds of things like prosperity, security. And then he says, if you disobey God, you will experience curses. Okay? And there's even one in there that sounds exactly like what's going on with Job. If you do these things, he says in verse 35 of 28, the Lord will afflict your knees and legs with painful boils that cannot be cured, spreading from the soles of the feet to the top of your head. And I think it would be very easy, I would argue, with the benefit of hindsight, these are collective blessings and curses based on how the nation is doing. So I would argue that if you were an Israelite living under this covenant, you could not say, God, you have guaranteed me that I will get all of these blessings and none of these curses or anything like these curses if I'm doing what you want. I think whether these are things that would generally be experienced in Israel, if enough Israelites were doing what God wanted. And one example of how this works out collectively is like when the Assyrians came to town, we know there were some faithful Israelites. But you don't get to say the Assyrians only attacked the unfaithful people, right? The whole nation experiences that consequence. Similarly, when David is king and Solomon's king and their socks are being blessed off, there are probably some Israelites far from God that get vicariously blessings they don't deserve, because I think these are ultimately collective. But I would bet it would be really easy to think of this individually, especially if you're living in it and you want these blessings. And so I bet there are people that are looking at Job and thinking the circumstantial evidence is pretty strong, Job. They're right where Eliphaz is. You must have done something because look at what you're experiencing. So I think Elihu is also important for the audience because I think what he's saying is probably right where a lot of Job's audience is. I think not so much in modern people by and large. All right. So anyway, introduction to Elihu. Elihu is angry. I think that could be why. Interestingly, he's also angry with the friends. So he's angry with Job for justifying himself rather than God. He's angry with the three friends because they found no way to refute Job and yet had condemned him. Yet had condemned God. But he's kind of like the guy who's watching the political candidate for the party he likes lose a debate. And he's sitting there thinking, the answers are obvious. You should be winning this debate, and you're stinking up the joint. I'm angry at you because you can't win this debate you should be winning. So Elihu's sitting there thinking, the three friends should be winning this argument. If it reads, yet had condemned God, then what Elihu's thinking is, you're so bad at this, you're making God look bad. So it could be that, or it could just mean, because Elihu has no reason to be mad at them for condemning Job. So he's mad that they can't put Job in his place. Well, why hasn't he said anything? Now Elihu had waited before speaking to Job because they were older than he. But when he saw that the three men had nothing more to say, his anger was aroused. So he really must have been angry because we're told like four or five times in those verses, Elihu's angry, which generally isn't a good state of mind to be in before you give a speech. It usually doesn't help your logic. But that's where he's at. And Job's all about being honest about your feelings. So we probably better stop there. But next week, I think we'll be able to cover Elihu. And to give you a little foreshadowing of it, one of the things that's interesting is some of the commentators despise Elihu. They think he is the most arrogant dude ever. I would argue that's going too far, and that he actually does have some really interesting ideas to contribute that none of the other friends have said, but I'm still going to find things to criticize anyway. So that's a little foreshadowing. All right. Have a great week.